May it please the court.
May proceed.
Mr. Amick argued in his first point relied on that the trial court erred in replacing juror number 12 with an alternate juror after the jury had been deliberating for about 5.5 hours. I'd like to begin there. The General Assembly...
And then once the new juror joined them, they only needed 10 more minutes to finish it up, right?
Exactly, Your Honor. The General Assembly created the parameters for the use of alternate jurors in Section 494.485. And there are two relevant clauses in that statute. First, it states that jurors shall replace jurors who, prior to the time the jury retires to deliberate, to consider its verdict, become or are found to be unable or disqualified to perform their duties. And next, it states that alternate jurors who do not replace principal jurors shall be discharged after the juror retires to consider its verdict. Now, there's very little question in this case as to what this language means. This court stated in State v. Johnson that the only statutory exception to the use of alternate jurors applies when deliberations have already begun. The question is what should happen when this statute is violated.
Were alternate jurors allowed prior to the statute?
The common law actually indicated, and I'm taking this from the state's brief, I believe in a footnote, that the common law said alternate jurors were not allowed. But this statute essentially gave courts authority to use alternate jurors in the first place. The state cites a case, State v. Friend, a Southern District decision from 1980, and argues the Southern District stated statutory provisions detailing the methods by which services of additional or substitute jurors are obtained are directory. So they're saying those statutes are directory. And at first, that language looks pretty bad for my position. But when you actually read the case, it's not talking about alternate jurors. When the Southern District says substitute jurors, they're talking about the original veneer panel. In that case, there were three people scheduled for jury duty, couldn't make it, and the clerk substituted three people on the veneer list. And there was some technical defect in the way they were substituted, but the Southern District didn't explain what it was, but it was not significant. So I agree, in that case, there was no prejudice. And I know there have been a lot of cases cited so far, but I have one more that I think this case is a lot closer to if this court is using jury selection to apply to the alternate juror cases. Now, that's State v. Sardazen, 174 Southwest 3rd, 598. It's a Southern District case from 2005. And this court cited Sardazen in 2013 in State ex rel Sitton v. Warden. This court described Sardazen by saying a computer error that caused prospective jurors to be seated in the courtroom according to their ages constituted a substantial failure to comply with the jury selection statutes because it destroyed the randomness of the jury selection. And in that case, the Southern District determined that that substantial failure to comply warranted automatic reversal without a showing of prejudice. Now, I don't believe jury selection, in terms of the veneer panel, has much to do with the alternate jurors here, but it's Chapter 494. But if it does apply, then certainly this case is much closer, and maybe even goes beyond what happened in Sardazen. It's much closer to that than State v. Friend. And that brings us to the cases cited in the briefs where other states have determined this was structural error. I cited cases from the Supreme Courts of Connecticut, Tennessee, Wisconsin, Arkansas, and Kentucky, where they have held virtually identical statutes constitute per se reversal. And if you look at these cases, there are essentially four things these courts say you can do when a juror cannot make it through deliberation. First, the defendant can agree to 11 jurors. Second, you can postpone deliberations until the juror is well. Third, the defendant can agree to seat an alternate juror. Or fourth, you can declare a mistrial. Here, the defendant was not asked if he would agree to 11 jurors. The record is pretty clear he would not have agreed to that. The defendant actually suggested postponing deliberations. He suggested just waiting until after the 4th of July weekend, telling the jury not to discuss the case. The trial court rejected that. The state didn't give its position, but it certainly didn't voice support for that suggestion. He did not agree to seat an alternate juror. In fact, specifically objected to seating an alternate juror. So really what was left was a mistrial. And that's what should have happened in this case.
Did he ask for a mistrial?
He did. He asked several times for a mistrial.
Is there any instruction that you can contemplate that would permit a complete restart of deliberations with the use of an alternate?
Well, there's a new federal rule, which, so our statute 49445 is based on an old federal rule. There's a new one that specifically requires trial courts to tell the jury to begin deliberations anew. I'm not sure that would work in every case, but the trial court did not do that in this case.
Mm-hmm. And can you put the genie back in the bottle? I mean, if you discussed it for 6 hours and say, forget what you just discussed. I mean, I know we operate in legal fictions, but how far can we go in this legal fiction of saying, well, go back like you never heard, you've never discussed it before, and start over?
Well, I don't know that you can. But let's look at Okade versus State of Wyoming, cited in the state's brief and my reply brief, where they give three factors. So I believe the structural error is the better view.
But your opponent argues that all these cases that you're citing from other jurisdictions, they were preserved errors. And in this case, it's not a preserved error.
Well, I disagree. And so the trial attorney made several objections, and I admitted in my transfer application, initial brief, and reply brief, he did not cite the statute.
But during trial or in the motion for new trial?
That is true, Your Honor.
Okay.
But he did object to the procedure. So here, trial counsel made several statements. He said to call back juror number 14 would create an enormous amount of error at this point. Later said that's not something we can just substitute in somebody else. It pains me to say that's a mistrial. And in my opinion, it is basically clear we have a couple options, either a mistrial at this point, or we could potentially break at this point, send the jurors home, instruct them not to discuss the case anymore. We could reconvene after the holiday. After 6 hours of deliberation, we can't just throw somebody else into the ring. That's not the way it's done. And I think it's either a mistrial or we can break and reconvene Tuesday morning. We're just trying to ensure a fair trial for Mr. Amick.
So are we reviewing this under plain error standard?
I don't believe so. I think this is preserved error because he is objecting to the procedure. Let me give an example that I was thinking of yesterday and this morning. So if a party was introducing a business record in trial and counsel says, I object, they don't have a proper custodian of records, and leaves it at that and says that again in the motion for new trial, would anyone doubt that that error is preserved? He doesn't mention section 490.680. But would anyone believe that because he didn't mention that statute, that the error was not preserved?
Well, or is it that we would think, well, that's certainly ought to put the judge on notice that that's what he's talking about. But in the motion for new trial, wouldn't most counsel go ahead and cite the statute, the business record statute? I mean, we're really talking about two times when you have to preserve error, right? That trial and then their motion for new trial. It isn't out of the ordinary that you could preserve it at one stage and then later waive it at the other if you failed to bring it to the court's attention.
Well, I don't know that you would have to specifically mention the statute in that situation. And I don't know that there's case law specifically stating you have to mention the statute.
You're saying where you give the reasons that are set out in the statute would be different if you'd given different reasons.
Exactly. The
one place that the record may support that you did waive an argument was that the trial counsel rejected the state's request to give an instruction to the jury about deliberations once the alternate joined. And trial counsel specifically said that he agreed with the court's decision not to give an instruction at that point.
And again, this just goes to prejudice. This doesn't go to the overall claim. Trial counsel, I will admit, was being very agreeable about the instructions.
Except here, in fact, the trial court did then go ahead and instruct them to continue deliberations. So if the trial court had said nothing, that might have been a waiver. But here he did give an instruction, but it was
the
under your argument, an erroneous one, that if he said anything, he'd have to say you should begin deliberations anew. So he did instruct them, but incorrectly.
Yes, Your Honor. And I would point out that trial counsel also agreed with the state that the jury needs to feel like a new group. And so he agreed with that proposition as well, and the trial court didn't do anything to make sure they felt like a new group.
And in fact, there would be a question as to whether, under the facts of this case, beginning deliberations anew was sufficient.
Yes. And I think if you look at the Montana case, or Wyoming case, excuse me, that it would not be necessary, even if that particular claim of prejudice is waived, because of the length of deliberations before the replacement and the short length of time after replacement.
And can you address that? Opposing counsel says we don't really know how long it is, and you say 10 minutes, but in fact we don't know exactly how long, but do we have parameters?
Yes, I agree that it's not exactly clear. Counsel said 8 minutes and 10 minutes below, but it's not absolutely certain. We know that there is a 65-minute period, and we know that in that 65-minute period, the jury deliberated. This is after the alternate. So the jury deliberated, the jury comes in, the jury announces the verdict, the jury leaves, the trial court questions the alternate juror, juror number 14, about if she had enough time to deliberate and to think about everything. And then there is a discussion where counsel is once again objecting to this process that goes on 10 pages of the transcript. And then there's a recess taken. And then they come back on the record. So all of that happens in 65 minutes.
And 65 minutes is when the recess was taken or when they came back?
When they came back. We don't know how long the recess was. But for all of that to have taken place in 65 minutes, even if it wasn't 10 minutes, it was a very, very short amount of time.
Did they re-vote the, usually instructions don't you shall elect a foreman, did they re-select a foreman, did they do all the things about having a jury?
I don't see why they would have. The judge told them to continue their deliberations. So I doubt they did, and there was
so
no...
So continue, not start anew.
Yes, Counselor, sir. You'll have some time on rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court, the reason that the trial court gave that instruction rather than the instruction to begin anew was because the defendant opposed the instruction to begin anew. The prosecutor specifically suggested that the jury be instructed to begin deliberation.
No, he didn't say, don't give that instruction. He said, we don't have to read. What exactly did he say? Because he did not acquiesce in giving the continued deliberations.
The trial court suggested he wasn't going to give it. The trial court said, I'm not going to do that, and then said, is that
the trial court said,
okay?
I don't think I can do what the prosecutor is suggesting by giving oral instructions. Do you agree with that, Mr. Woody? Mr. Woody twice said that he agreed with that.
And what oral instructions was he saying he didn't think he could do?
I think the context of the both before and after that discussion is around the concept of instructing to begin deliberations anew.
But he instructed him to continue, which is wrong. So that's different than not. He said, I'm not going to instruct him, and then he did.
And had defense counsel given the judge the proper advice, which is the prosecutor is right, you have to instruct them to begin anew, perhaps that error wouldn't have been built into the case for exploitation on appeal, which I believe is a classic case of sandbagging. That's why you have affirmative waivers.
Did defense counsel say no, just tell them to continue deliberations?
Defense counsel opposed any oral instruction at all.
Okay.
Even though he may not have cited the statute in the motion for new trial, he did clearly say he wanted a mistrial at the trial, at the court.
That was the remedy he suggested. He did not, but when you give an objection, you're supposed to give grounds for an objection. He never cited the statute as a grounds for an objection.
But he cited grounds. He didn't cite the statute. He cited the grounds that are in the statute. He did not cite the statute.
He cited various grounds. I believe there were, but he did not cite the statute itself. But the more key thing is that the motion for new trial doesn't contain that claim at all. The only thing in the motion for new trial says the length of deliberations was short. There's no reference to any provision of the Constitution, so all constitutional error has been waived in the motion for new trial. And there's no reference to the statute in the motion for new trial.
And so why does that require? What's your authority that there has to be a reference to the statute in the motion for new trial?
Well, I think you have to preserve your claim, and if your claim is based on the statute, then you should have to cite
well,
the statute.
That give it the court?
Even, it doesn't even cite the instruction as being error in the statute.
I understand, but does that give the court sufficient notice? Does that put the court on notice of what the substance of the complaint is? I mean, there's some statutes, like a service letter, and there, in the service letter, you're required to specifically, in the service letter, mention the statute by name, by number. And if you don't, then the service letters fail. But the legislature knows how to do this. How have they done this here?
I don't think that in this motion for new trial there's even anything like the claim that's being discussed. The only thing he complains about is that the juror was only in there for, and he changes the number back and forth. He says 10 minutes in one sentence, 8 minutes in another sentence, and that the deliberations were a sham. That's all he says.
But isn't the purpose is to put the judge on notice of what the complaint is, and was that accomplished here?
I don't believe. I think had the statute been cited, that the trial judge could have looked at the statute and decided whether or not.
So what if I objected that something denied my right to equal protection? Did I preserve that argument, or do I have to cite the U.S. Constitution, Fifth Amendment, and the comparable state constitutional one, or can I say this violates my right to equal protection under the federal and state constitution, or just my right? I mean, where do you get this requirement that you have to cite the statutory or constitutional basis? Specifically, if you give the substance of those provisions?
I think clearly the law on constitutional grounds is that the constitutional claim has to be cited and preserved at each stage of the process.
Well, that, so there's no case that says you have to say
now, whether
U.S.
you have
Constitution,
to say
Fifth
Amendment is opposed to equal protection clause, I mean, maybe not.
Says denies my right to equal protection. You would say that's not preserved.
And if you said it denies my right to equal protection under the U.S. Constitution, yeah. I'd say that's preserved.
But that's not my question. So if you could is there any case law that says what you're saying, to repeat the Chief Justice's question, that says, as opposed to whether this was adequate to invoke those grounds, you're saying if you don't cite the statute, you're out. It's not preserved. I'm not familiar with the case saying that. And I wonder if you could cite me to it.
Well, even if you don't have to specifically cite the statutory section, I think this language that's in the motion for new trial does not remotely invoke the statute. All it talks about is sham deliberations, length of period of deliberations, which, if anything, may be a reference to the constitutional claim. It's certainly not a reference to the statutory claim. There's nothing in the motion for new trial at all that says it's illegal to substitute a juror.
Well, so, now the motion for new trial does not make a substitution claim? Statutory or constitutional, or does it make a substitution claim and doesn't say what the base, whether it's statutory or constitutional?
It says the excuse and replace the juror, and that the juror was only there for 8 minutes, and that it was a sham deliberation. That's all it says. And again, this 10 minutes thing is not in the record. There's nothing remotely in the record other than the defense counsel's statements. Self-serving statement that it was 10 minutes. The parameters, as discussed, are at 5:55. We know that the judge calls the jury into the courtroom to make the replacement. At 6 o'clock, the jury's already back out of the courtroom, and the trial judge explains what his reasons for doing what he did were. And at 7:05, the verdict is stamped in. Now, as to the length of the recess, if you look at the transcript right before the recess, the judge says, instructs the clerk to stamp the verdicts in. And then when they come back from the recess, which was really just walking to the chambers to make the record, the judge says it's 5 minutes after 7.
But so. A lot of things happened during that time period. I mean, there was a discussion on the record about multiple things.
There was.
Going into chambers. There was discussion in chambers. So clearly a good portion of that 65 minutes was utilized by other things.
I don't know if I'd agree a good portion. I mean, some of the time was used. No question.
But what about the
There were relatively quick issues. It's how, you know, I want the additional time for the motion for new trial. I want the bond changed. I want to set a date.
How much time was defense counsel given to prepare the motion for new trial in this case?
He was given the extra 10 days, I'm sure.
What is your response to the law in other states that this type of process is structural error?
I would say
if it's structural, it does not need to be preserved.
Right. And I would say two things about that. One is that Missouri has never held that in jury statutes that it's structural error. There are three categories of jurisdictions. One says that it's per se prejudicial, in essence, structural error. One says that there's a presumption of prejudice that it can be rebutted, and one says it's the defendant's burden to show prejudice. We're in the latter category on all these jury cases where there's been an alternate replaced. It was true in State versus Williams. It was true in this court's decision, State versus Reynolds, State versus Anderson, and Williams versus State. In all those cases, the court did a prejudice analysis. So I think that that's the category we fall into. Second response would be that our statute is specifically based on former Federal Rule 24C. There's a large and rich body of case law on former Federal Rule 24C, which had identical language, where the federal courts interpreted it as requiring a showing of prejudice. There are numerous cases in our briefs that indicate that. And finally, the U.S. Supreme Court has held in the Olano case that the prejudice had to be shown, and it wasn't structural error.
Is it in a case where
there was an alternate juror back in the jury room who may or may not have been communicating with the other jurors?
Isn't there evidence in the record that supports a showing of prejudice? If you look at cases from at least three other states, they talk about how a juror should never be released when it is for circumstances having to do with the dynamics with the other jurors, where the person wants out because of the nature of the deliberations, not simply because of illness. And in here, the juror specifically said he couldn't stand the pressure. He had no idea it was going to be like this. So there's all kinds of indication in the record that it is not illness, but it is the deliberation process that is causing him to be ill because of the relationship with the other jurors and the dynamic.
Well, respectfully, Judge, I would suggest that that's a credibility determination that the trial judge had to make about whether this was a real or a feigned claim of illness on the part of the diabetic juror. I mean, certainly, I have a diabetic. I mean, stress does spike your blood sugar in diabetics. There's no question about it. And this judge found, the first time, he even went the extra mile and sent him back to try again. And it wasn't until the second time when he came out and said, it's blurry, I can't even process what's going on in the courtroom at this moment, that the judge reluctantly, I think, decided to replace the juror. But I also would say that it's analogous to the case of Commonwealth versus Oliveira, which we cite in our brief, which is a decision in Massachusetts where you had a juror who they knew was a holdout, as contrasted to here, where the jurors complained about other people arguing who probably may not have been a holdout. But in that specific case, the court held that because you have to replace a juror who is unfit to continue deliberations and cannot continue deliberations and tells you he cannot continue deliberations, that's the reason you're replacing him. It's not because of how he's voting, and therefore there's no constitutional violation. So the only preserved claim in the motion for new trial was affirmatively waived by the defendant. And here there's clearly no manifest injustice or miscarriage of justice where the money, the truck, and the gun all tell you that the defendant did.
Well, the motion for new trial says defendant moved for mistrial or that the court recess for the weekend and allow us to return Tuesday morning for continued deliberation so the juror could return well rested. The court declined and excused the juror, replacing him with another juror, stating the juror had heard all the evidence. And she said she hadn't discussed the facts, and defendant then moved for a mistrial, which was overruled as a result of the court action. So why isn't that enough to preserve? And then he goes on and talks about the time and that there was only 8 to 10 minutes for them to deliberate, and that was inadequate. So he objected on multiple grounds in the motion for new trial.
Well, I think all he's saying there is mistrial and number of minutes. I don't see anything there about Constitution.
Well, you should read paragraph 59 then in 60, which I just quoted to you.
Says the juror couldn't continue deliberating that day and couldn't make a decision, which is grounds for releasing you. It says they telephoned the alternate juror. who had heard all the evidence and did not discuss the facts with anyone. I mean, he does make the suggestion about returning on Tuesday. I agree with that. That doesn't cite a grounds why it's error to do
it. It moved for a mistrial at that first, and then asked for a recess, and that wasn't allowed. Then he moved for a mistrial again when the court denied it. And then he moved for a mistrial because of the inadequate time for deliberations.
I would agree that he took the proper action in moving for a mistrial. I would disagree that he cited the proper grounds, or any grounds for that matter, other than the length of the deliberations, which is not the claim that's made on appeal. So I think that this is not the case where you want to reward the objection to the proper instruction, which would have cured the defect, and particularly in light of the overwhelming evidence.
Why would that have been?
Are you confident that under Missouri law, if the trial judge would have reinstructed the jury to start anew, that would satisfy?
That's the only thing that's missing among the federal cases that deal with the U.S. constitutional claim that we cite. I mean, generally speaking, they look at whether or not the juror was tainted, and I think all parties have agreed in this case the juror was not tainted.
Opposing counsel doesn't agree to that.
Well, my understanding is that the way I understand Mr. Buffalo's argument is he's saying that these statutes have displaced the common law that did not prohibit or that prohibited alternate jurors. And as I understand his argument is that absent strict compliance with the statute in every way, not just what happened in this case, that alternate jurors are not permitted. And the way I understand his argument is none of these, absent an express agreement by defense counsel to waive a statutory provision, that there is nothing that could be done in this situation other than granting a mistrial. And that may not be his argument. That's the way I understand it. Well, you can correct me if I'm wrong.
I don't think that's what the case law in Missouri holds. I mean, in Johnson, you had the situation with there were bifurcated trials. I mean, we know from the Johnson decision of this court, you can bring a juror in who may not even agree with the guilt phase verdict during penalty phase, because that's considered a separate deliberation or a separate verdict. In the Reynolds case, this court held that there was no prejudice where an alternate had conversations with other veneer members prior to joining the jury. In Williams, the Eastern District held that the juror did not necessarily lose their alternate status merely by being technically discharged before being recalled after a lunch break.
But wasn't it because the court found that the jury had not started deliberating, and that they retired, therefore there hadn't been a violation of the statute?
I think that's right, Your Honor. Yeah, but they did hold that he'd been technically discharged. So if it turns on discharge, I'm arguing it doesn't turn on. The person doesn't lose their alternate status just because they've been discharged, and they can be reconstituted. And that's what the Evans case that we cite in the Fourth Circuit held. They had the same two problems in Evans. And first, they held that former Rule 24C, the basis for our statute, doesn't say that you can't, even if someone's discharged, they can't be reconstituted as a juror. They replaced a juror who was unable to perform his duties. They determined that the juror his mind had not been contaminated. They found that there were 12 people who could properly dispose of the case. No, even though they were not instructed to begin the deliberations anew, didn't mean that they did not begin deliberations anew. They held that speculative assertions of prejudice were made at trial.
You have a number of cases that have one issue, such as the juror was discharged or whether they were instructed. But in this case, you have probably five or six factors that all come to play in one case. That the juror was discharged. The juror wasn't just discharged. She left and she was gone for a significant period of time. You have a six-hour deliberation. You have the juror indicating stress in doing this. You have the juror saying, when they said, well, did you have enough time to deliberate after in this short period of time? And the juror said, that's okay, I really did. I kind of pretty much had my mind made up. You have all that was the alternate who came back. You have all these factors in one case, where the cases you're citing to us, they have one thing that was questionable in the process. Should that make a difference to us that this happens to be kind of the, I started to say perfect storm, but multiple factors, multiple questionable practices all came together in one case, and should we find under those circumstances that there was not a fair trial?
I think you're right in looking at doing a prejudice analysis. I disagree that there was only one problem in the other cases. Evans, for example, had the exact same two problems. They didn't instruct him to begin anew, and they violated Rule 24C. So I think a prejudice analysis is required, and you have to determine whether or not there is prejudice if it's preserved error. But this is not preserved error. This is a case where you have the defendant specifically objecting to the instruction to begin deliberations anew, which is the main, which would have been the main problem in the case, in my view. But when the defendant specifically objects to that, I don't know why we would want to encourage someone to specifically object to the thing that would fix the problem in the trial court and then get relief on appeal because they specifically objected in the trial court.
Counsel, your time has expired.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you for your argument.
Mr. Buffalo, when you received this case to prepare it for argument, did you know that that alternate statute, juror statute, was out there?
No.
Okay.
But I'm not the trial court.
No, I understand. So the purpose of a motion for new objections at trial to put the trial court on notice that you think something's wrong.
Yes,
what's
right.
The purpose of the motion for new trial?
To allow the judge to reconsider their actions during the trial court.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you agree it would have been better. I mean,
I think it would have been better advocacy for trial counsel to cite Section 494,
yeah.
485.
Yeah. Is it fair to think that trial counsel, given extra time to file this motion for a new trial, would have found the statute that you rely on so heavily at this point?
I'm not sure.
How long did it take you to find it?
Well, Craig Johnston had already prepared a brief in the Southern District when I took over the case. So I read the briefs, essentially. But there were multiple points in the motion for new trial. It's a scrambling time for people. That 25 days seems like a long time, but mm-hmm. counsel has other cases, mm-hmm. and you're going
How much time did the trial judge have to work mm-hmm. on this before seeing the motion for new trial after having completed the jury trial? I mean, he's in the
yes.
same box as the defense lawyer, right? We all have
yes.
other responsibilities.
Yes.
And we want to put the courts on notice as soon as we can if there's some defect so that if the case merits new trial, it can be retried.
Yes, Your Honor. And my argument really boils down to defense attorney objected based on the procedure, based on the reasons for the statute, and trial courts are presumed to know the law. And when you factor in both of those things, the trial court was on notice that the trial court could have fixed this mistake. I'd like to respond to three different things. First, State v. Evans, which was brought up, is completely inapposite because there the defendant specifically stated he preferred an alternate to a mistrial. So he sandbagged the trial court and then on appeal tried to say the trial court shouldn't have done this. That is different than this situation, clearly, where he objects numerous times, makes everyone know he prefers a mistrial to an alternate. So it's the opposite. State v. Williams, the Eastern District case, where the alternate juror was discharged, but the jury had not begun deliberation. And there was some question of whether it's discharge or deliberation that matters. It's deliberation that matters. I think under the statute, it's deliberation when you combine that. So the jury had not begun deliberating yet. So that's what matters here. And then State v. Johnson, this court's case, this court specifically held that the actions there complied with the statute, and therefore it's inapposite here. So whatever prejudice standard was used in Johnson doesn't matter to this case because this court found the actions complied with the statute on the use of alternates. Here it does not comply, so this puts it in the case of the structural error states, and this court should follow those. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The matter will be taken under submission.